We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The zombie apocalypse is imminent. Could you survive? You'll have a better chance after completing Geek Nation Tours Zombie Apocalypse Training 101. Learn to fire weapons, scrounge for food, and actually run from zombies. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Hey, yo, and here we go. We Talk Comics is on the air and in your ear, as we like to say. I am Mo. I'm joined by three other gentlemen. We're going to actually, you know what, let's do this. I'd like to throw a surprise at the beginning of the show, have something fun. So why don't you guys introduce yourselves by telling us who your favorite all-time Spider-Man writer is. Go ahead, Chris.
That's a tough one because, I mean, there are so many. I'm going to go Peter David, I think.
Peter David. Mostly Spectacular Spider-Man, but good stuff there. Keith?
I am Keith, and I would answer this question differently every time you ask, probably. I'm going to go with Jerry Conway.
Jerry Conway. And our special guest, the man who is the voice of the long box and is here to talk about his new book from Throwbent, Paul O'Connor, because last week, I'll admit, Paul, I called you O'Connell until Brett corrected me. I was like, how the hell did I do that? And it's probably because I've been watching rugby and there's a Paul O'Connor doing that. So, anyways, and I don't that, like rugby, but anyways, Paul
that's
O'Connor
quite all right.
At the Long Box Graveyard. And I can't believe I did that, but I'm apologizing for something I did last week and I'll apologize for whatever it is I'm going to do in advance this week. Your favorite all-time Spider-Man, Spider-Man writer.
Well, fear not, Mo. I'm happy to be on your show at whatever name you choose to assign me. My favorite Spider-Man writer. I'm an old school guy. I mean, I'm the oldest old school guy. So I'm going to say my favorite Spider-Man writer is Steve Ditko.
Steve Ditko?
Was the artist. But if you choose to believe the rumors, he was writing that book, even though Stan Lee's name was on the masthead. So I'm going to pick Steve Ditko.
I'm pretty sure, if nothing else, we can say that there, even if he wasn't writing it during the first few, I mean, probably by 15 issues or so in, isn't that probably when, for sure, I mean, it was pretty much him.
Yeah, I think, and I don't think there was really anything nefarious about it. I think Stan would take his hand off the wheel if his co-creators could do the scripting. He was happy to have them do that. But I'll stick with Ditko anyway.
All right, and we're going to get some background noise from me now as my dog has decided to chew on a bone. And you know what? I got to be honest with you. I love my dog too much to say no. So let's move on to a very awkward opening. Paul, what's new with you?
We never got your Spider-Man.
Oh, you know what? For me, I got to go. I would go Roger Stern. I mean, Roger Stern for me. I mean, you hear that?
Yeah, how come we have four comic book fans and no one said J.M. DeMatteis?
I mean, DeMatteis.
How did that even happen?
And you know what? The thing is is his work is that, and I'm not sure, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing the name right there, but we had Tom DeFalco tell us how to properly pronounce his name, and yet I'm still sure I'm getting it wrong. But, you know, I liked a lot of the Marvel team-ups. And a lot of the Marvel team-ups that I enjoyed was actually him writing it. So, I mean, he's definitely up there for me. And then, of course, he's got
I'm not dissing Roger. I'm just saying.
No. And Kraven's Last Hunt, obviously. You know, I mean, that's an iconic story. But
and, I mean, we need somebody younger to show to Dan Slott. I mean, we're leaving so much on the table here that
Dan Slott, I'm offended.
There's so much talent that
I would like to backtrack though that you know, Chris, you did have an opportunity to say any of these people.
I only got a chance to say one. I had to say more.
You know, I think Don Slott, I'll say this about Dan Slott. I'm pretty sure he would make – like if you took a poll and did favorite writer, he'd make the top 10. And at the same time, if you did least favorite Spider-Man writer, he'd make the top 10. I think he's the only one who'd do that.
The current main writers will probably always be in that category.
Maybe. Maybe.
I'm sure at the time Paul just absolutely despised the grim and gritty Roger Stern and DeMatteis stuff.
What did you think of that stuff when it was going on, Paul?
They all have their place. They all have their place. And I think Dan Slott does a terrific job. I don't particularly like his latest Amazing Spider-Man series, but I think it's a very good book. It's just a good book I don't like very much, but so I think Slott's actually been very good on Spider-Man.
We got a Spider-Mobile, man.
That's right. Well, that forgives a lot.
We have a Spider-Mobile.
The Spider-Mobile forgives a lot. If I can unearth a really obscure Spider-Man writer that I like quite a bit, because you mentioned Marvel Team-Up, my favorite era in Marvel Team-Up was written by Chris Claremont. And he did about a dozen episodes or issues, I think, of Spider-Man that I thought were really, really good. They were fun.
You know, if we're going to go guys that are a little more under the radar that a lot of people don't talk about, I liked Al Milgrom when he was doing Spectacular Spider-Man, mm-hmm. right around, you know, between the 90s and the 100 and that range. I liked the work he was doing with Kingpin and Black Cat and stuff. So, I mean, that's somebody who's for me, kind of you're under the radar guy.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. So, all right, let's move on here. Quit talking about Marvel. They get enough press. Let's talk about Thrillbent. And Paul, you got this book. It's available free to read, called 4 Seconds, on Thrillbent on the website. Give us the genesis of this, because this is kind of an interesting story. I don't know how much Chris and Keith are actually familiar with this.
Yeah, it's a long and crazy story. So jump in if I bloviate too long here, because I could talk all night about just the origins of this book.
Well, first off, I'm going to have to look up Belobiate. So now,
you'll just see a picture of me if you look that up. So Thrillbent is Mark Waid's digital comics publishing platform. You can go to thrillbent.com and see it. Mark started this, I want to say, about 5 years ago, maybe not that long, maybe three. He had, Mark believed at the time, I think he still believes, that digital comics were the future. And Mark doesn't just talk the talk. He walks the walk. And he put his own money into starting Thrillbent as a place to publish digital books, both his own and those of other creators. I think there's probably about, two or three dozen series at Thrillbent right now. And as a person that loves comic books and is interested in digital, it's something that caught my attention. So I was a Thrillbent fan way back when he first started the site. A couple of years later, flash forward to 2014, Mark announced that he was going to do a contest at San Diego Comic-Con where he would invite creators or prospective creators to come to his panel and to pitch him his Thrillbent writers on an original comic book idea, and the winning pitch would be published at Thrillbent. The only stipulation was that your pitch could be no longer than 15 seconds. If you ran over 15 seconds, they'd hit the buzzer and you'd be ejected. So that opportunity came around at an odd time in my life. I live in Southern California. I have professional status with Comic-Con, so I'm very fortunate. I'm able to go to the show every year, even though I haven't published a comic of my own, since 2005 or something. And the bulk of the work I did in comics was in the 80s and the 90s. So it's a long time ago, but I still go to the show every year. So I was going anyway, and I'm a fan of Thrillbent. And I happened to be between jobs at the time because the mobile game developer that I was running was winding up, and I didn't know what the next thing was going to be. So I thought, well, what the heck? I'll try, because I like to pitch. It's one of the things I do in my secret identity. I'm good at it. And I'm really interested in comic books right now, and I'm interested in Mark's platform, so what the heck? I'll go pitch for Thrillbent. And I had I had about a month, I guess, to think about things ahead of time. And I immediately did what any other comic book fan would do when they had this kind of opportunity. They picked their favorite idea that they've carried around with them, like a teddy bear, dozens of years, and try to compress that idea down to a 15-second pitch, which is hard. But I did it. I did come up with a pitch based on a comic book property that I had originally had tried to sell to Malibu Comics in like 1990 and always thought that it had overlooked potential. I thought, great, that's what I'll go there and pitch. And I worked on that pitch and I honed it and I honed it and I honed it. And then the night before Comic-Con, I'm sitting in my living room and I read it and I go, this stinks. and the reason was, it wasn't a bad pitch, but it didn't have any particular snap. There was nothing about it that was special that would distinguish it from another comic book idea. And even more important, I realized to my horror, there was nothing about the pitch that took advantage of the way Thrillbent tells comic book stories. So a diversion, Thrillbent does comics. They're not motion comics. They're not, there's no soundtrack. There's no spoken word. They're comic books. They're words and pictures juxtaposed together in panel and page structures. The reader controls the pace of the experience with an advance. You know, they press the advance key and they go to the next frame or the next update of a frame. They're very clearly comic books, but they're not like a comic book you'd experience on paper necessarily, because you can do all sorts of amazing, interesting things, primarily with transitions. You can do wipes. You can do fades. A lot of the cinematic techniques that comics attempt to incorporate on paper with varying degrees of success work very well at the Thrillbent platform. And then likewise, you can hold on a static image, update a portion of it. So you can change an expression, or you can, in the case of a conversation, you can update balloons, remove some, bring others in. You can play with sound effects. You can drop backgrounds in and out. There's lots of really cool stuff that you can do. And I looked at my pitch and I thought, I'm not doing any of that. I just did a conventional comic book story. What's wrong with me? So I sat there and I said, well, crap, I guess I'm not going to do it. I quit. I'm not going to do it. And then I thought, why don't you just give it 15 minutes? I said, I'll just brainstorm for 15 minutes and I'll work backwards. I'll come up with an idea that I think works at Thrillbent, and then I'll see if I can shape a 15-second pitch from it. And that's what I'll pitch. So I started with the idea, it has to be a relentlessly visual story. I want it to be contemporary. I want it to be complete in one sitting. And it's got to do something that I think this technology really, really will do well. And I decided that precognition was the thing, because the nature of this tech, I thought I could kind of see a way forward, that I could show the way a person might look at a dangerous situation and then see immediately into the future and the different scenarios they might that might occur if they go left instead of right, or they zig instead of zag. So with that idea, it's like, okay, precognition, contemporary story, 15-second pitch, go. And I just built the log line on the spot. I just built the pitch. I said, okay, I need a protagonist. I need an adjective to describe the protagonist. I need what's opposing the protagonist. I need emotional stakes. I need this. And I got carried away, and I came up with about half a pitch that night. And I went to bed thinking, okay, well, at least I won't embarrass myself. I can try this tomorrow. And then the next day I was riding into Comic-Con with my friend Chris Ulm. And Chris was the editor-in-chief of Malibu Comics back in the day. Chris is one of my best friends. I've known him for 30 years. He and I, we were partners in that iPhone business at the time. We're still partners in our new business now. And I respect Chris deeply. And, of course, as editor-in-chief of a comic book company, he's heard lots of pitches. So I tried it out on him, and the pitches I had it. And he said, okay, I kind of get it. I like this part. I don't like that part. He liked the premise. He liked the precognition and the way I was describing the character. But I didn't really like where the story was going. It was too specific. So, okay. Keep that in mind. I rewrote it a little bit in the car. And then when we got to Comic-Con, I went to lunch, and I had lunch with my friend Matt Wilson. Matt Wilson is the president and creative head of a company called Privateer Press. They do a game called War Machine. They're located up in Seattle. Matt's a very talented guy, an enormously talented painter and writer, and has spent a lot of time in Hollywood pitching screenplays. So I laid the pitch on him, and he kind of looked at me and said, all right, well, the first half of your pitch is kind of cool, but the back half isn't working because you aren't giving me a twist. And I think, geez, I have a premise and a twist in 15 seconds. How on earth am I supposed to do this? So no, there needs to be an and then. You need to set me up. It's like a punchline, like a joke. You need to set something and then pivot and have a punchline. So I remember what the pitch is. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. So I wrote some ideas down. And then I went to the pitch panel and I put my name in the hat. And the room was packed. It was one of those mid-sized rooms at Comic-Con. It wasn't like Hall H or anything, but it was pretty big. It was probably, I don't know, 300-400 people in it. And Mark's at a lectern, and he has all his thrill bent creators up there, guys that are already on the platform. And he says, we're here for this pitch contest. You're going to get 15 seconds. He outlines it. Then he goes to each one of his guys, each one of his judges, basically, and says, tell us about your project that's currently on Thrillbent, and tell us in 15 seconds or less. And he goes right down the line. There's 8 or 9 of these guys that all have work on the platform. Not one of them could summarize their work in 15 seconds. You know, they're just crashing right through the guardrails. And, you know, they didn't have a chance to hone their pitch. I think Mark kind of sprang it on them, but it was kind of an ominous way to start the panel. It's like, wow, these guys are the pros in the room, and they can't do it. So what's going to happen to the rest of it? So then we see the list. We stand up there to do the pitch. You stand up in the middle of the room. There's a microphone in front of you. Everybody's staring at you. That's fine. I don't mind that so much. But it's hard for a lot of the people in line. And I'm second. I go, oh, okay. And you flash back to when you're in grade school or something, and no one wants to give their oral report first. And the teacher kind of winks and says, well, if you go early, we'll give you extra credit. You know, you just, oh, God, I'm nervous. I don't want to go second. But the person in front of me is giving their pitch, and I think, you know what? If I can make an impression, if I give a really good pitch, it's an advantage to go first. Because what will happen is it'll cement itself in everyone's mind as one of the front runners. And then every time someone comes up behind me, it'll be compared to my idea. Is it good? Is it not good? Is it better than what Paul did or less? Not as good as what Paul did. And I thought, as long as they're thinking about me, I got a chance. So that scared away my blues, and when it was my turn, I stepped up to the microphone and I gave my pitch, and the pitch was this. I said, 4 seconds is a noir thriller about a petty thief who discovers she can see 4 seconds into the future. That's just enough precognition to get into trouble, but not nearly enough time to pull off the heist that will save her sister's life. That was it. I think that if you run the tape, that was probably 15 seconds exactly, or 14.5 or something. So I gave that pitch, and you could hear a pin. There was silence in the room, and then Mark said, "That's a great pitch." It's just like his immediate reaction, and I thought, "Okay, I've won." Not that I've won the contest, but I pitched an idea. Mark liked it, and that's victory enough. You know, I don't need to get the job. But I knew at that point I was in a really good position, because he immediately started saying, I like that idea because I can see how it works at Thrillbent. I thought, yes, yes, my long night of figuring things out paid off, because I identified what the client needed. And my experience in giving pitches is you want to give just enough detail about something to suggest a story to the person you're pitching to, and then you want to shut up because that idea goes into their head and it flowers into something they think is really cool and they fall in love with, even if you haven't told them those things, and then you get the deal. So Mark was very enthusiastic, and you know, there were another 90 odd pitches after me, and we went through a couple rounds of elimination and some consultation. But at the end of that hour, Mark said, you know, plenty of great ideas here. He's very excited about all the ideas he heard. But he said, the winner is 4 seconds. And I went, son of a gun. I won.
Wow. Wow. That's pretty cool.
It was cool. It was really exciting. And it gave me a lift at a time. And we were, you know, I was between jobs. And I was feeling kind of, you know, down, isolated about, you know, doubting my own creative abilities. It was great to be able to do that. But then on the way home, I had one of these oh crap moments, which was now I got to write this thing. And all I have is I said I have 15 seconds of 4 seconds. That's all I've got. I had the pitch. I had nothing else, because the pitch was Frankensteined in a lab to be an effective pitch. There was no story behind it. But I figured, okay, well, I can unpack it. There are a lot of power words in that pitch. And I'm getting to figure things out. And I'd written a comic book before, or several comics before, so that wasn't unknown territory. But I also came to recognize just the magnitude of the opportunity that had been handed me. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, this is insane. Nobody gets this deal. You know, we were talking about comic book writers to start the show. We mentioned Dan Slott, one of the most accomplished writers in the business right now. I think his Spider-Man's very good. I really like his Silver Surfer. But it's not like anyone goes to Dan and says, publish whatever you want. Here, I'm going to print your comic. Do whatever you want. Full stop. It doesn't happen. And what Mark had done is he had guaranteed me, assuming I could turn in something that was printable, he'd guaranteed me a story that I could print. And I didn't have to worry about selling it, you know, in a solicitation through the Diamond catalog. I didn't have to worry about variant covers. I didn't have to worry about engaging the interests of a jaded readership. I didn't have to worry about anything except making it as awesome as I could. There was no concern that, geez, we better sell 15,000 copies of issue one, because when it invariably drops to 8,000 in issue two, if we're lucky, that we can stay in business. None of that. It was just, you have a platform, go make a story. And I thought, okay, I may never get this opportunity again. No one gets this opportunity. And at that point, I realized that my mission was to make this story the best story I could make it, to leave no effort, leave nothing behind, just go in there and try to write an awesome comic book story, not just in terms of narrative, but also in terms of visuality and the way the story was told. And that was my mission.
All right, guys, you have any questions for Paul based on that? Because I know I have a few, but before I just take over and start peppering the guy, I'll give you guys a chance.
And when did your artist jump into the picture? Because I think you got lucky on that one.
I sure did. The artist is Carl Kiesel, and Carl
comic
is
book awesome. Legend.
Yes, Carl is awesome. Carl came in. The idea was drafted. I did the treatments, and I wrote a full script before Carl got involved. But Carl saw the script and then said he wanted to do the project. That he had to do the project. So what happened was I had written the script and Mark, gradually gotten Mark more and more interested in the project. I mean, at first he was kind of nervous, like, who is this guy? Can he work for me? Is he going to deliver on time? But over the process of the next couple of weeks, as we worked together, I think he gained confidence in what I was trying to do and started to get real excited about the story and kind of took his hand off the wheel a little bit and let me complete a script that frankly was longer and more complicated than I think what he wanted initially to publish. And all credit to Mark for, because he, you know, he financed this thing out of Thrill Ben's pocket, that he allowed me to kind of move the goalposts on him, I think is, you know, he's a stand-up guy. But we were trying to find an artist, and he had a stable of artists he's accustomed to working with and other people he was trying out. We looked at two or three different people, all of whom had strengths. But when he told me that Carl had read the script and really wanted to do it, I said, that's our guy. You know, that's it. Stop. and Mark said, you know, Carl's a pro and I don't think we should ask him to do a tryout. I said, hell no, he doesn't have to do a tryout. His tryout is his body of work that he's been doing for the last 30 years. Carl's great. Let's get him. And what mattered to me most was that Carl's a storyteller, that Carl, in addition to being an artist, is a very accomplished writer. And most of all, that Carl had actually done a product at Thrill Bent before, and that he really, really, really was enthusiastic about the story and wanted to tell this story with me. So that was it. Yeah, Carl was our guy.
Why don't you hop in, Mo?
You don't have any.
I'm still ruminating.
You're still ruminating. All right. All right.
Okay.
My turn. Chris, fight. Okay, go ahead.
I was just wondering. The stuff that's available now, it ends on sort of a cliffhanger.
I know, Chris. Chris, you can't go there because you're going to ruin. You're going to this.
Oh, I'm chastised enough.
Oh no,
I'll go back into my corner, Mo. You take over.
You can't. But the thing is, it ends on a cliffhanger. You're wondering if there's a sequel. You can't. I don't want to ruin the problem. The problem is here's the thing, and it's true. Like, it does end in a way that's not necessarily favorable for the character.
Sure.
But I don't want to ruin the ending in any way. Like, I'm really careful about how we approach that.
No, it's okay. I appreciate you tiptoeing around it. The ending in the story is, you know, I spent a long time with it, and I'll admit I'm not 100% satisfied with the way it came out. Eventually, and that's just on me. Carl and Mark both said, no, it's good. It works. You know, it's okay. And I went through two or three different endings before we arrived at the one that we had. If you're sensing that it kind of ends in the middle, that's because it does, or it actually ends at the 1/3 mark. What happened was, you know, Mark said, do a short story, do something that's self-contained. It's not the first chapter in a new series. It's a story that's complete in one sitting. And he has several of those at the Thrill Bent site. Fine, I'll do that. I'm delighted to do it. But it's hard. I mean, it's hard for me. I go on at length. You can tell. I'll talk all night. And telling a story in a short period of time, short story takes a lot of discipline, especially in a visual format. So I thought, well, how on earth am I going to do this? And I was able to walk Mark up from, you know, originally he was thinking it's probably about, in paper, it'd be about an 8-page story. And by the time we finished, Carl said it's about a 30-page story, you know, based on his, because it's, you know, you do panels, it's not one-to-one because of the format on Thrillbent. But he said it's about 30 pages worth of work. So I walked him up to a full issue story, but, you know, complete and one-issue stories are hard to do. It's like, ah, what am I going to do? And I thought, I just can't pay off a full character arc in 30 pages. How am I going to make this work? So what I flashed on is I wrote a beat outline, or a treatment and an outline for 4 seconds as a screenplay. And what became the comic is the first act of the screenplay. So act one of a screenplay ends at, you know, the 20-25 minute mark, and it ends with a shock, with a twist that spins the action in a new direction and directs you into the second act, which is kind of unexpected based on what happened in the first act. So I thought, okay, that's where I'll end it. I'll write this thing as a self-contained story. If there's never another chapter, it can end there. It's a little ambiguous and it's kind of grim, but it's a noir, so that fits. But if there's an opportunity to tell another chapter, which I'd dearly love to do, then I can pick up and it won't be artificial at all because I know what happens next.
If nothing else, you can give that to us.
No, I give that to no one. That's a secret. You know, so everyone's got to go to Thrillbent and read 4 seconds and say, click that link about 1,000 times and tell their friends and click that link about 1,000 times and leave comments. Because seriously, the more activity we can get around this particular story, the better case we can make that poor Mark should open his wallet to the tune of another several thousand dollars to publish another chapter.
That's the thing, though. I mean, it's free. There's no reason why somebody shouldn't read it.
That's
right. I mean, it's free. But when was the decision that it's free made? And how did you feel about that? Were you kind of like, oh, or is that exciting? Or
no, I was totally delighted. And I said, you know, my secret agenda after I got the story, my public agenda that I always came back to with Mark and with Carl's, I said, look, I may be a pain in the ass as we're doing this thing, but it's all about the work. I want to make the work awesome. When I did comics back in the 80s and the 90s, you know, I did my best, but they weren't always awesome. If this is the last comic I ever do, I want to make sure that I can go to the big long box in the sky thinking I did great work. This
long
one
boxes.
Thing. Yeah, I could say when I lay down, on my long box of Native Earth and take the big nap, I can say I did 4 seconds and it was really cool. Maybe the audience didn't love it, but damn, it was a good story. So it was all about quality, quality, quality when I was working with those guys. But I had two secret agendas. And one of the secret agendas was make it longer so I can tell a more robust story and maybe, you know, start a new character in a series here. But the other one was this has to be free. And the reason it had to be free is from my experience working in mobile games, the difference between something being free and something costing a premium price like 99 cents is impossible to overstate. When I years ago we did a mobile game through my old company and it was selling pretty good sales actually 200-300 copies a day at 99 cents. This would have been about 2008, 2009, early on in the days of iOS. And, you know, respectable sales. We set it free. We reduced the price from 99 cents to free just to see what would happen. And we went from 200 or 300 downloads a day to 1 million downloads in 5 days.
Wow.
1 million downloads. And this was just with viral marketing. We didn't have a lot of exposure. And at that point, I realized a couple things. One is that we're doomed because my company had been set up to build free, you know, premium games, and the market was clearly saying, no, you've got to do free games. And the mechanisms weren't really in place to make money off free. Now, of course, that's how every game works. But at the time, we didn't know how to do it. But it also told me and showed me the power of a mass audience. And you could only reach a mass audience if something is free. So my goal with 4 seconds, go back to that first principle, right? It's like Mark said, here, publish this. And I thought, yeah, I will. And I, you know, it's not that I don't care about making a profit for Mark. I hope he makes millions of dollars off Thrillbent. But my goal was to make a great story and get it in front of as many people as possible. And that would only happen if it was free, because Carl has some cachet in the business to be sure, but nobody knows who I am. And the genesis of the project is interesting, but not interesting enough to overcome, you know, it's not going to be a destination for people to go there and spend money. There's a subscriber base at Thrillbent that would see it, of course, but I wanted to make sure that everybody could see it. So Mark very graciously, gracious all along the way, very graciously said, no, let's make this a free title, at least for a limited time, so that as many possible, as many people as possible could see 4 seconds. And that's what he did. God bless him.
I hate to tell you this, but as a matter of fact, this episode is supposed to be our very first one we're ever charging for.
There you go.
About $100 actually was the plan. And no, that's very interesting. I don't understand how, you know, it's free. Okay. A lot of people see it. So how then do they judge it as a success? I mean, how does it make money for Mark? And Mark goes, okay, let's do another one because, and make that one free too. Like, that's the confusing part to me.
Sure. Well, in my stump speech in the game business, I say the problem with free is that it's too expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if something's free, like in the mobile game space, companies will pay $5, $8, $10, sometimes more for a verified install of a free game. The cost, just because something's free doesn't solve your discovery problem. It's still very hard to get something in front of people, but free at least removes that first barrier. I think for Mark, the win would be if it results in increased traffic to his site. And ultimately, you know, if that traffic monetizes in the form of new subscribers to Thrillbent, that's his model at Thrillbent. Thrillbent is not, it's 100% subscriber based. He doesn't take advertising at the site. So really for him, it's traffic. It's not like 4 seconds by itself is going to generate a lot of traffic. He put together the Thrillbent contest, I think, because he was trying to get publicity for the company, and also because he genuinely wants to, you know, break people in the business and see what's out there. He's an interesting, you know, creative guy, but ultimately he needs people to go to his site. So the concept of a contest might do that. A paid 4 seconds isn't going to get him any kind of bump in traffic. An unpaid 4 seconds might. Certainly it'll get more than if it's paid.
Well, now he's going to get the WeTalk bump.
Oh, yes, yeah, of course. You're going to blow up the servers. I expect him to be blowing up right now.
Even though the
podcast won't be live for a day or two.
That's right.
It better blow up right now. So I hope that he'll get a bump. And then there's also, you know, the collateral benefit. Maybe you don't need a lot of people to see it, but you need the right people to see it. Yeah. You need someone that is interested in, you know, developing it as, you know, film or television property, or you need someone that's interested in taking it to print, or you need someone that's looks at Thrillbent in a different way because this story is told in a real inventive and interesting way, and they decide, hey, I want to get involved with Thrillbent some fashion. I think there's a lot of benefits that Mark can generate from additional traffic.
Now, what was Mark's he found out about your history, I'm guessing, probably pretty quickly, that you had worked for Malibu and that you had written comic books before and that you weren't somebody who was just off the street who had no history, you know? Was he kind of like, oh, this isn't what I was looking for, or was that exciting for him? It's like, okay, that appeases me a little bit. I can trust that this guy has a concept of the medium at least, or how did that go?
Well, I told Mark, I said, congratulations, Mark. It's a great day for diversity. You've broken another 50-year-old white guy into the comic book. And, you know, he kind of rolled his eyes and gave me a smile, you know, because Mark, being a 50-year-old white guy in the comic book business, you know, he knows fully well that, yeah, we got a lot of those guys. And this might have been an opportunity to get another more diverse voice out there creating for him. To his credit, Mark decided it would be a meritocracy, and he liked my pitch the best. I think that, you know, the fact that I'd done comic books in the past was neither here nor there with him, frankly. You know, he didn't know my work. I didn't make a big deal out of it. I didn't mention, you know, mutual acquaintances that he might know. I just made it real simple for him. I said, look, I'm going to do the best job I can. I'll put the work in front of you. You tell me if it's good enough. You tell me what changes you think are required, and we'll just go forward from there. And I think, you know, there was a professionalism in terms of, you know, my communication style with him that put him at ease. I think that was irrespective of having a background in comics. It really didn't play into it. It did make the narrative a little strange at first, because there was like an article that went out right away, published in a New York newspaper, I can't remember, about, you know, Thrillbent gives comic fan a chance of a lifetime kind of thing. That was the narrative that they were trying to develop, but that doesn't really ring true when the guy that wins the contest is someone that's done this before, however long ago it was.
Now, does Mark kind of work with you to mentor you in the Thrillbent way of telling a story, or?
I think he would have been happy to do it, except that I just jumped into the pool so fast. You know, Mark's, he's like the busiest guy in comics, right? He's doing four or five books in any given time. And he's working for two or three different publishers at a time, and he's always hustling up new work, and he has Thrillbent. It's not like he was going to take a big time and put me through a boot camp or anything like that. And also, the very first thing I did after I got the job, when I came home the day after Comic-Con, is I renewed my subscription to Thrillbent, and I went on the site, and I read everything that was there, and I broke down every time I saw a technique that I like, I broke it down and built a shot list with a URL that pointed that specific part of that story and named everything and defined what it was. I called it the Thrill Book. It ended up being about, I don't know, 15, 20 pages long of here are the cool techniques that are used in all the different stories. And then I sent that to him and I said, look, this is my shot list, the stuff I want to do for Thrillbent. He said, wow, I'm going to share this with the other creators. So I think that cemented in his mind that I knew his platform really well, and he didn't really have to mention it in that regard.
So, Paul, aside from what was on Thrillbed, did you look at other comics that were done in the Turbo format, in the stepped format?
Not as much. I thought Marvel experimented with Infinite Comics for a while. Yeah. I'm not sure if they're still making them or not. And Mark did one, actually. Mark and did a Daredevil Infinite book that ran about four issues, I think. And I actually thought that there was some good stuff there. Like Brian Michael Bendis. Now, there is an author that I have a love-hate relationship with. I think he's great, but I don't think he's great as a comic book writer, because there's no visuality to his work for the most part. It's very static. Great dialogue, but it's more like a television show than a comic book half the time. And, you know, God bless him. I wish I was as successful I could write as well as he does. But it always struck me that he isn't taking best advantage of the form. But then he published an Infinite comic.
From your mouth to God's ears.
but then he published a comic in the Infinite format for Marvel around Guardians of the Galaxy. And
it was really good.
It worked. Yeah. It's like the man in the moment.
And with a character like Groot, where there isn't dialogue for him to.
Yeah. Or any of the guys. Yeah. It's just really, really good. And I looked at it and said, okay, finally, So, I looked at that comic for sure. And that gave me a little encouragement. I said, we can make this work. If the kind of story I want to tell, that I'll be able to have more dialogue than would normally be the case in a comic story. So I don't want to lose people with page after page of talking heads. It's just more dynamic to do those panel updates and do other visual tricks we ended up arriving at. But I realized, no, this can work. So, I mean, there were some examples out there like that, but it's not like this format, unfortunately, hasn't taken off, I think, as much as Mark would have liked. And there aren't a lot of other examples out there about this kind of storytelling right now.
Well, could you give us a little bit of a sales pitch on the Thrillbent site, what titles we can find there, so our listeners will be intrigued if by some bizarre circumstance 4 seconds isn't enough to draw them to the site?
Because right.
There is some fantastic books on that site.
But every single one of them, I want you to tell us about them in 15 seconds. Go.
Yeah. As I recall, the creators couldn't pull that off. Oh, my goodness. Well, Thrillbent, like I said, it's a mixture it's all creator-owned, for one thing. I mean, that's the first thing I'll point out, is that this is a platform for people to put their own ideas out there and do things that you don't see at other publishers. subscription based. So you come up and a subscription is really, you know, it's very reasonable. It's like $4 a month or something. And frankly, if you wanted to get a subscription and then just binge like crazy, you could probably go through the content on the site in a month or two. They have a combination of continuing stories and single issue stories. They have books that are really tightly integrated with the Thrill Bent format. And then they have books that are, more conventional comics, like he's reprinting Strangers in Paradise at Thrill Bent, for instance, and it doesn't use the Thrill Bent format at all. But of the books that use the Thrill Bent format, I would call out, geez, they're all really good. Probably the flagship book is Insufferable, which is Mark Waid's own book. That's in print now from IDW, I believe. Insufferable, I think
it's Boom. Is it
seconds,
a Boom?
Yeah, maybe it's a Boom.
I'm pretty sure it's Boom.
My mistake. I know that he has a relationship with IDW for some of the other properties that's real bent. So if I got the publisher wrong, I
could have gotten it wrong too, but I just I seem to recall when Boom was here at the Expo Calgary Expo a couple of years ago that was on their table. So
okay, I may well have gotten that one wrong. So Insufferable, for lack of a better description, is kind of Mark's take on a very dysfunctional Batman and Robin. It's except Robin's an asshole, if I can use that term. He's a publicity hungry, lying, cheating, conniving, underhanded, untrustworthy person who also happens to be Batman's son in this case. The main character. And that's about their very difficult relationship. Yeah. So Insufferable, I'd certainly recommend. And that's one of the longer serials on the site. I think Mark's done three full story arcs with that. There's another property here called Moth City, which I'd recommend. Moth City is kind of a roaring 20s, two-fisted pulp adventure type story. Again, with several dozen chapters. What I really liked about Moth City is I thought it was one of the properties that really used the Thrill Bent technology really well. You get a sense of place and mood and light changing and interesting transitions. Good story, but also especially well told. There's also, I'm flipping through the site here, see what else pops to the top. There was a fantasy series called Valentine, which I thought was very intriguing, and contemporary political thriller with a horror twist called The Eighth Seal that I think is also still current. I think they're still adding chapters. I remember Eighth Seal was also very impressive.
Yeah, Valentine's one of the books that really pioneered this format.
Yeah.
It had been done free through a website, and it was one of the first things on Comixology, actually. It was a free comic.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, there's lots to explore here, and none of the Thrill Bent stories are any worse than average, and several of them are very good, and all of them, I think, are interesting in terms of the way they're telling stories in new ways. I can't emphasize enough that I think comics fans have a lot to enjoy here. I mean, I totally get it that people don't want motion comics. They don't want – the problem with a motion comic, it's in this uncanny valley between animation and a comic book. It's not as good as a cartoon. It's not as – good as a comic book. It's like some but it's really expensive and cumbersome, and you need special technology, and why would you ever do it? I think what's happened with Thrill Bent is Mark's figured out how to give you a comic book but really take advantage of the digital format.
All right, well we do want people to go on to Thrill Bent, read 4 seconds, and that way we can get that next chapter. And then you say that's part two out of three, though. Is that what you said?
Well, it amounts to the first act. So in terms of just runtime, I'd say if I was going to finish the story, quote unquote, do additional chapters, it would probably be three more chapters.
So then you'll come on for the next one, and when Chris jumps about and starts to talk about the end of it, I'll unfairly jump in and tell him he can't do that again.
Yeah. Just because I like telling you you're wrong, Mo. Insufferable is from IDW.
It is from IDW. Well, there you go.
Yes,
you
so go. Paul's okay. Right. However, the companion series, Incorruptible by Mark Waid as well, is on at Boom.
That's probably where I got it confused. Well, so basically what you're saying is we're both right.
I'm saying you're wrong.
Oh, okay.
Well, there is no way you can come out on this being right.
Well, hey guys, this is good. But do you guys want to just, while we're here, just do a little bit of general comic book talk?
Just Paul, have you read a comic so far in the century?
I have.
Fantastic.
I've read a couple. actually, I've read quite a few recently, actually. And I'm not sure why I chose to do this, but I decided that I'd write capsule reviews at my site, longboxgraveyard.com. I decided I'd write capsule reviews at that site, one a day, of all the new Marvel number ones, because they have this reboot going on, the This Time We Mean It reboot. Or I think it's called All New, All Different, as opposed to All New, whatever the previous one was. But anyway, they rebooted everything from issue number one, and I thought, all right, I'll try them. I'll jump on. I'll buy them all, commit to buying them all in print. They'll shell out a couple $100, and I'll read them with my friends at work, and then I'll write a capsule review of one every day. And I've hit pretty much every weekday since, I don't know, August, September, whenever they started coming out.
I'm gonna
read a lot of comics.
I'm going to correct, because it's a pet peeve of mine. Relaunch. They're relaunches.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, one of the criticisms I have, one of the meta criticisms I have is so few of these number ones are number ones. They don't make a real attempt to onboard new readers in any meaningful way. It, clearly, in most cases, it's just a renumbering stunt. You're right.
Well, reboot means that you have dumped the previous continuity, and none of
yes.
them are doing that.
You're right.
What does rebirth mean? Have we figured that out yet?
As we record this, we are less than 24 hours from finding out what the hell rebirth means.
They say it's not a reboot, right?
They have said specifically it's not a reboot.
A relaunch.
It is a relaunch, in all likelihood. Mo and I both predicted relaunch when we did our predictions. That is what we're expecting. I'm kind of expecting number ones, just like a full line of number ones, similar to all new, all different, all sexy Marvel Now.
all singing, all dancing. But not a new 52. Year. Not a new 52 specifically, which was like a new universe or a new take on the old universe or something.
Yeah, that was a full reboot where it actually dumped the old continuity and started with new origins and new sexes and new diversity and new readers, because the old readers were all furious.
Yeah, I guess.
Marvel just retcons that in.
I think so.
Marvel's more built on the retcon is kind of their bread and butter too.
Even the purpose of these relaunches seems to be a moving target. I mean, when New 52 came out, it was, at least we assumed, I don't know if it was actively positioned this way, but the assumption, as I recall, was that it's for new readers. That's why else would you do it? And
new readers and lapsed readers was one of the ones they specifically said.
And then a year later it was, no, it was never about new readers. It was about reactivating our base. And so there's a tendency with companies, and I totally sympathize, to kind of shoot an arrow and then paint a bullseye around where it lands.
I think that's totally fair.
Yeah, I think that was the case with New 52, but with All New, All Different Marvel, having read all the books, and they're pretty good. Some I like a lot. I don't really know what it was or who it was for, because it doesn't do any good for new readers necessarily. Too few of the books make any attempt to welcome new readers. It doesn't make the Marvel Universe any more streamlined, really. After Secret Wars, you still have multiple versions of heroes running around, and you have fractured timelines and other dimensions and all the stuff you might normally clean up, right? It doesn't make the books more familiar to a broad audience. I mean, we have female Thor, female Wolverine. I like those books, but you're not going to recognize them. You won't recognize Spider-Man if you're coming from the movies. You won't recognize the Guardians of the Galaxy are a bit of a challenge to understand versus if you're a fan of the films. So it's not closer to the movies. It's not more welcoming to new readers. It doesn't really clean up the continuity of the Marvel Universe. So why do they do it? Aside from the crass and quite necessary reason of we got to goose sales because we're in trouble. There's narratively, I mean, there was a Secret Wars event, which is very cool. But narratively, they didn't really change stuff enough to justify canceling all those books and starting over at number one. Not fictionally, at least. I don't think
you've really hit on something here, Paul. That to me, what scares to me to death about the comic book industry is, where is that next reader coming from? Because if they're not coming from people who are watching the movies, and the evidence isn't that they are, then they're certainly not coming from the people who pick up that book for the first time and don't feel like they can jump in. And it used to be so well done. You know, if you were just a DC reader, you could still pick up a Marvel book and you'd get it, because the language of comics spoke a certain way, and they would make it inviting, and you'd go, okay, I get it. And, or if you were a young reader, you're 8 years old, you could read a comic for the first time and you'd get it. Now those people, I mean, unless you're a Marvel reader, it doesn't feel like there's a way to get into being a Marvel reader right now. So I just wonder where that next generation is coming from. And I mean, it's a problem.
I know where the next generation is coming from. They're coming from thrillbent.com.
Yes, that's right.
That's where we're going to find new readers. Well, I mean, a digital free product is one way to maybe reach new readers, but there's still the discoverability issue. And you're right. I mean, comics used to be a lot more welcoming to new readers. Jim Shooter, when he was editor-in-chief of Marvel, he did a lot of crazy things. We could talk all night about the good and the bad of the Shooter era. But his directive was to his writers was, you have to assume every issue is some reader's first issue, and you better make sure they come back and read a second issue. So the writers, that was an imperative. They made sure that every issue was welcoming, and it led to some expository and awkward dialogue. You know, the Avengers were always referring to each other by their full name in their first panel appearance. So everybody would know, who the swordsman is or whatever. But it worked. I mean, they did onboard readers in that time, and you don't now, I think. I think they've just kind of given up, frankly.
Now they'll make a passing reference to somebody's first name, and you'll be lucky. Yeah. Maybe if you'll figure it out like 5 pages later, going, that was that character from 2 years ago.
Yes.
I read the Earth 1 – or Earth 2 Society number 1 from the DCU relaunch last year, and it went through the entire issue without – mentioning that that in that universe, Dick Grayson was Batman.
This is not just a Marvel issue, that's for sure.
Yeah, we're 30 years into eventitis. I mean, 31 years this year since the original Secret Wars, which is really where everything 32. Changed.
That was 1984, I believe. Was it 1984?
I thought they did Secret Wars last year because it was the 30th anniversary, but you could be right. I don't know. Maybe it ran 84 to 85 because it was a 12-month.
That's right. Yeah.
But that was really where things changed, where the entire continuity was a bigger thing. Like before that, you might have an offhand reference, you might have a crossover between two books, but that was when people started talking about whether stories counted.
Yeah. Well, it was smaller, right? So, like in Marvel's Silver Age. Right, and into the early Bronze Age, mm-hmm. the continuity was something that Stan Lee at first, but later on, like Roy Thomas, basically held in their head, and that was good enough. And the writers kind of informally worked with each other, and they had all the benefits of collaborative work with each other, but they not a lot of the restrictions. DC, notably at that time, really didn't do that. I mean, all their editors were siloed, and they were competitive with each other, and that's why you might read a Flash comic. And the character in that comic seemed to have nothing to do with the version of the Flash you saw in Justice League, for instance. They just the writers didn't care.
We can fix all this with editors' notes. We need editors' notes in the corners of all the panels.
That's right. It ends up with the footnote being bigger than the panel at some point. you're right. I think things did pivot with Secret Wars, for better or worse, and then Crisis, you know, following shortly thereafter. But also was a change in the market from newsstand distribution, which was all built around issue number 258 of something that the retailer knew perfectly well how much they could sell, because there were 257 previous issues that they'd sold. It changed from that to, let's excite the interest of a direct market audience that is maybe a little speculative about things and is interested in new things. And when issue number one, when that number one on the cover sells and number five on the cover doesn't, well, what's going to happen? You're going to have a world where there's lots and lots and lots and lots of number ones. And that's the world we have now.
And the evolution of the trade paperback as a viable form, collecting the stories, I think also has something to do with this, because if you're going to be viewing it as a story arc that's going to be collected for trade, and that's how it's going to be distributed in the future, you're not necessarily going to sit there and reintroduce the swordsman five or six times.
you know, because but it's an issue. Like I really, like I say, I just don't see we need a gateway drug. That's what we need in comics.
Well, it is something. Yeah, Jerry Conway said. Jerry Conway said when he was on a while back that you used to write serials, and now you're writing a graphic novel split into six parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, clearly, and they end up being very decompressed. So we go back to our friend Mr. Bendis, who we mentioned earlier, who really kind of like ushered in that era, I think, in a big way when he was writing Ultimate Spider-Man. And Bendis's works are really great when you sit down and read a stack of them. If you read, you know, you're reading 18 pages every 30 days and it costs you $5 each time, you want to blow your brains out. But if you got a collection, or, you know, you can rip through them on digital or something, then his long reads are just wonderful. So, yeah, I mean, that is a very different format. You're right. And if anybody knows, it would be Conway, who wrote successfully in the old era and is writing successfully now. I actually thought his Carnage was among the better books in this Marvel relaunch. I thought he did a real good job there.
What are some of the other books then that for you are your favorite in the relaunch? And what are some of the ones where you were a little disappointed?
Well, see, off the top of my head, and I invite readers to go to longboxgraveyard.com.
Yeah, after they go to Thrillbent, though.
That's right, after they go to Thrillbent. But go to Longbox Graveyard, and on the top banner you can click. There's a link for all new, all different Marvel.
And after
now,
they go to
all
We Talk Podcasts.
Yeah.
You're third on the – yeah, already, you're – yeah.
They never leave We Talk. All no, right? I mean, that's right. That's their homepage. That tab is always open. Okay. No one ever leaves. That's why you have so few hits, because people come and they stay.
That's right.
You have to get them to log out and come back.
No one ever leaves. You cannot get out alive.
That's right. That's my story. I'm sticking with it. So, yeah, some of the Marvel relaunches were good. I thought as a whole, the X-Men books were pretty good. The floor in them was fairly high. The only book in the X-Men relaunch I didn't really like that much was Old Man Logan, and that just kind of came down to preference about the art. It was a little too craggy for me. The other books weren't breakout or anything, but they were
Sorrentino.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And so they were going for kind of a spaghetti western vibe, and maybe it vibrated just a little too much.
Did you read the Old Man Logan story that
I did? Yeah, back in the day. Yeah, the original was fine, and this isn't bad. I wouldn't say it's a terrible book. It was just kind of borderline for me. The others were all entertaining. I mean, none of them were, you know, Days of Future Past, right? But all of them delivered.
Even the one that was Days of Future Past.
That's right. But all of them delivered characters that were recognizably the X-Men and were doing X-Men type things, and young mutants coming into their powers, and we got to save these people and round them up, and there's good mutants and bad mutants, and they were very entertaining books. I thought Hercules was an excellent book by Dan Abnett, I think, was the writer on that. And I don't like Hercules at all. He's a character I've never cared for. In fact, I'll as much as I love the Roy Thomas era Avengers, when they do the Hercules stories, I kind of roll my eyes. But I thought the Hercules book was really good.
You know, I got to say those two Hercules miniseries that Bob Layton did.
I remember
80s,
back way
those
back
were good.
Then, yeah,
I like those.
Yeah.
He did three actually.
He did three,
way.
Did he? Okay, I think I only read two. Awesome,
yeah, but I only read two as well.
The premise of this new series is very approachable. You know, it's like Hercules is the world's first superhero, and is he still relevant? And Herc, he's kind of a screw up and he knows it. And what can he do to repair his image? And can he still be useful in today's world? And I thought, boy, just as a single issue, it was really good. I liked Karnak. I think only one issue has come out of Karnak.
Yeah,
so
there's only one. It was supposed to be 2 weeks ago that the second one came out, and I don't think it has.
Yeah. It's delayed. You know, my 15-year-old self would love that book to death. It is so relentlessly grim, grim, grim. You know, everybody's wearing hoods and they're angry all the time. So it's kind of one note, but it's a good note. I like that one.
And, so it's the Ramones.
That's right. And I like some of the Tweenerverse books they've done, too. Now, they haven't branded it as the Tweenerverse. I give that to Marvel for free. They should brand it as the Tweenerverse. But books like Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl and Hellcat Devil Dinosaur and Moon Girl, they all kind of feel like they live in the sort of the same universe. Back in the old days, we would have called them sidekicks or, you know, Teen Titans verse or something. Now they're just, interesting young people coming to grips with adolescence and the strange powers and the weird lives that have descended upon them. And I thought those books were very good as well. As far as, you know, and then there's a lot of stuff that's in the Muzzy Middle. It's just very, you know, it's competent. The Avengers books for the most part. I like Mark's Avengers book. I like Captain America. I thought the new Hulk book was kind of fun. But then there were some, there weren't, to be fair, I don't think there were any outright flops. I didn't care much for Howling Commandos of S.H.I.E.L.D., sadly, because I love monsters and I love S.H.I.E.L.D., but it didn't quite come together for me. And I thought, you know, Red Wolf wasn't that hot, and I was disappointed with Scarlet Witch. I understand it gets better, but I thought the first issue was muddy and kind of a mess. And I restricted myself just to reading the first issue of everything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'll catch up with it on digital later if it ends up being good. So I thought the floor was pretty high. There weren't a lot of real dogs in there. But there wasn't any book in there where I look at it and say, this is really awesome. You can drop everything. You got to go read this. And maybe it's asking too much to say that you want to see a Thunderbolt like a Dark Knight or, you know, Alan Moore on Swamp Thing or something where you just feel like the universe has changed. You got to go read this comic. But I don't know, if you're launching 60 books, maybe one of them should be like that. I don't think that happened. I don't think that happened this time around.
Unfortunately, that seems to happen. That's once a generation, right?
So yeah,
that's why. Yeah, that's hard to do. How about a little general talk here? Any of you see Deadpool?
Yep.
Would you guys give me your guys' quick review, spoiler free reviews?
I thought it was hilarious. I thought it really captured the character from the time I remember Deadpool, kind of the Joe Kelly era. It is ridiculously not for children, so definitely take them. I hope that comic movies learn the right lessons from the success of Deadpool. Though I don't hold a lot of faith.
What are the right lessons?
To let the movie be what the character is. You know, in the same way that, Wolverine would have been a stronger movie had Hugh Jackman not chickened out and made it PG-13. If they had released the extended R cut, it would have been received better than it was as PG-13.
You know, I've read a lot of Deadpool, and they're pretty PG-13 in the comics. As a general rule. I mean, certainly the Deadpool you're talking about, the Joe Kelly.
What you can do in a comic is different than what you can do in a film, because film has a realism to it. Because you're looking at people, even if they're CG people, you're looking at people. There's things that you can't do in a movie the same way that you can do in a comic. In a comic, you can destroy the entire universe. You can wipe out half a city in every month of Avengers, and no one bats an eye. You do that in a film, and people freak the hell out. So, you know, there are things that Deadpool would do in the film that would be totally fine in a teen plus comic. There's a nude scene, like that's not going to work, and some of the language, of course, but.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with you, because I saw the movie and went, you know, I love this movie, yet I can blame every movie I'm going to hate for the next 3 years on this movie. I mean, it wasn't 3 days. It hasn't been 3 days since the movie came out, and they're already starting to talk an X-Force R-rated film. That would be the wrong way to go.
Yeah.
I think Wolverine would be right. X-Force probably wrong.
Interesting. Paul's any, I know you didn't see it obviously there. Any thoughts though on the film or the success of the film?
Well, you know, not seeing something has never stopped me from having an opinion.
No, me either.
I haven't seen it yet. I was surprised by the box office success, happily surprised by the success. You know, coming into the last couple years, the track record for R-rated superhero pictures was not great. The most successful picture prior to this last couple of years maybe was 300. You can find a lot of, you know, middling kind of underperforming pictures. Kick-Ass was okay, not great in terms of box office, and some real outright flops. Watchmen comes to mind. You will go back further back. The first Blade was R-rated and was a success, but it was patchy, and you could see why studios might be afraid of it. But there's been a sea change. That's, to me, the most exciting thing. I'm looking forward to seeing Deadpool. To me, the most exciting thing is there's really been a sea change in the last year, with Deadpool being usually successful, earlier or late last year with the Kingsman being a very successful R-rated comic book based property. And, you know, Mad Max Fury Road, which is an all timer as far as I'm concerned. I love that picture. Not as successful at the box office, but great critical acclaim. It's nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards this year, which is crazy. You know, all these mutants and mohawks and blood and guts and engines and stuff. That's an Oscar picture. So something has happened now where there's enough literacy in the audience and enough fanboys have grown up that you can put an R-rated genre picture in front of people and maybe it can be a success. And then I think maybe the hidden part of the story is, you know, Marvel's really worked to stretch their brand. They deserve credit for taking a risk, not just I know that Deadpool came from Fox rather than from Marvel Studios, but they do have some input on that, but not just the films, but also with their television properties. The Netflix shows, Daredevil and especially Jessica Jones, they go into some very adult territory, and they're saying, you know, Marvel is a brand that's got stories for everybody. You can come watch Guardians of the Galaxy, and no one could be really offended by anything in that. And you can also go watch Deadpool, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum, but it's all Marvel. And that's amazing. I don't think any other brand managed to do that. And when you consider that Marvel is owned by Disney, and Disney for years suffered because they lose people at adolescence, basically, and then get them back when they have kids. So they had an audience from 3 years old to 15, and then from 40 to forever, but they didn't have anybody from 15 to 40. Well, what have they got now? They've got everybody because of this very risky and very canny brand strategy that Marvel's pulled off. I think it's a gigantic story, not just in comics, but in movies and popular entertainment. It's amazing.
Well, do you guys think the movie will continue to have legs, though? I mean, that's the real question. Or is it, you know, do you think it's going to continue to do well?
I think it'll do well. It'll do well for a couple of weeks based on the number of people that, you know, were surprised by the film. I mean, they had a ridiculously good marketing campaign. I've never seen a campaign done as smoothly and with no cynicism to it. Like, it really, like, that movie was everywhere and, like, all over the place, different kinds of ads, and no one seemed to get cynical about it being everywhere. Like, normally you push a movie that hard and people get really cynical. The challenge it has is the number of places that it won't play, internationally. So that's going to cap it as far as its longer potential. Not playing in China is going to really hurt it long term. But it's going to, I mean, it was done on a fairly low budget as far as I understand it. And so it's going to do really well.
Yeah. It was just a little over 50 million. I remember. So yeah. That's this day and age.
Yeah. The sequel will have three times the budget and be half as good. Right. I mean, I think we all know that now. So enjoy it while it's here. I think it'll definitely have legs. I agree with the comment that it may not do so well internationally. So if we're just talking North American box office, I think it'll have legs, first of all, because it's February. And February is where you drop the bodies. You know, there's no movies generally in February.
Well, that's why, it had a record as a February open, not just an R-rated open, but a record as a February open. It was, I believe it was $280 million it made over the weekend. 150 of that was international.
It's just amazing. And, you know, because it was coming out in February is another reason to think, well, maybe it's a stinker, right? So, but it wasn't. And
I'm sorry, Paul.
So I think it'll sell, and also I think you'll get repeat.
I'm sorry, Paul. Can you repeat that point? We just kind of lost you for a second there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that in February there's very little competition, so it'll continue. It'll do well in North America. I think it's going to get repeat viewing because it's, you know, I understand it's just so rat-a-tat-tat that you kind of want to see it again to make sure you catch everything. And I think people are going to take their friends. Like, hey, you won't believe what I just saw. We should go. Let's go. So I expect it's going to have – I think it'll run through the rest of this month. It may run all the way up to you know, Superman versus Batman next month. I think it's got a real shot.
I think this is going to be really interesting if it does have legs. I think it's going to be really interesting to see if it could outperform Superman Batman.
Wouldn't that be something?
It would be.
I think it'll run at least until Daredevil season 2 debuts.
Yeah, well, that's the same day, right?
Yeah, we don't have a really. No, it's the week before. Daredevil's a week before Batman Superman. There's not a lot between now and then. 10 Cloverfield Lane is probably the only big release between there now and then.
I don't know if you'd consider that a big release. I don't know.
I think you'll be surprised. You think so? You
think just having Abe's name on there is enough?
Yeah, I do. I'm just going to be bold. I mean, I actually do expect domestically, Deadpool will have a bigger opening weekend than Batman Superman simply because it's the seventh highest opening for a comic movie ever. So it's higher than almost every one of the Marvel movies and one of the three, Nolan Batmans. So it's going to be hard.
If Deadpool opens bigger than Superman versus Batman, they will burn Warner Brothers to the ground.
I think Batman Superman is going to open huge and die quickly.
Yeah.
Is my sense at this moment. So I think it will open bigger than this, but I think it won't. I think it'll die pretty quickly.
It doesn't open bigger. Oh my God. Can you imagine?
It did open bigger than Man of Steel did though. It didn't open as big as Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises though. So it really depends on whether people see this as Man of Steel 2 or a new Batman movie.
Do you want to be the executive that's trying to explain to the Warner Board of Directors how you didn't just have Batman, you had Batman and Superman, the two most recognizable greatest superheroes in the world.
$250 million on this
one? Yeah, and all the money needed. And you couldn't be Deadpool? Can you imagine? Oh, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in that meeting. My God.
I'd take the job for the day just for the paycheck, because I have a feeling you get paid pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be a golden parachute on that day, but
the ghost of Jack Warner will come back, you know, and blow up the whole studio if that happens.
It'll be curious what happens over the next month, because then it's hard for me to know because I'm inside the comic bubble. And outside the comic bubble, like, you know, they played a Batman Superman commercial at the Grammys. And I just happened to do a search of Batman Superman on Twitter. And there was this ridiculous mass of people who this is the first time they'd heard of it. So like it's very weird because we're such inside the superhero comic.
Grammys got in a completely different audience than the Super Bowl.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, they don't even do audience tracking on new films until like 3 weeks out. So, yeah, I mean, most people make up their mind about what movie they're going to see on Friday. You know? Yeah. So I'm not surprised that the mass audience doesn't know it's there yet. We're nuts. So we track these things obsessively months in advance. And that's where I think they'll rescue it. It will be successful because those brands are so well known. Everybody knows Batman and Superman and. Yeah, cool. Let's go. Let's go check it out. But yeah, you're right. Maybe the more interesting thing to look at is the tail. How does it perform week 2, 3, 4, especially as it's leading into a crowded summer with plenty of other genre pictures packed behind it? How will it perform over time? It's a good question.
All right. Is there anything else comic book-wise you guys want to hit before we wrap this sucker up? Is there anything else on your minds?
Well, Paul, I know that – You've done a couple of rounds of looking at what DC's been doing. You did reading a bunch of trades and such.
Yeah.
Are you gonna do an experiment with whatever Rebirth is?
Well, I might. I'm thinking about it. I have enjoyed doing this number one issue business with Marvel, but it's also almost killed me. You know, it's a lot of work.
It's so hard.
And I'm kind of crawling to the finish line here. So it's I got another half dozen or so to go, and then I'm going to go fallow for a while. So I'll have to see where my enthusiasm is in June or July, I guess, when the DC books come out. And also, you know, what is it that they're doing? Are they doing something interesting that can re-engage me as a fan? I'm certainly interested as a fan. I'll read a few of them. Whether I go commit to reviewing them all, I don't know. We'll have to see about that.
We started the show just as New 52 was starting, so we did all 52 in a month.
Oh my god!
And then we did all the. We did the zeros as well. I think we did those in one episode.
We did that. It was 52 books in 52 minutes was the name of the episode.
My gosh.
We each had 15 seconds. See if that sounds familiar. To sum up a book. Brett usually took about 4, which gave us all a little extra time.
That's good.
Actually.
You know, you want to do something like that again and you want to invite me back, I'd be happy to participate.
No, I don't want to read that. No, maybe we would do that. Maybe yeah. We try and find a way that'll give us each 12 seconds, won't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm eager to see what they're doing, and I have friends over at DC. I wish them well. I hope they can be successful, and they certainly have a great stable of characters, and you know, maybe they can get it right. But I'm afraid that the nature of the market is it's still too many books chasing too few dollars, and I don't see where initiatives that kind of confuse the reader about renumbering and restarting. I don't really see where that grows the market. I think. And that was the criticism for, going back to New 52, it's the criticism for the recent Marvel relaunches is that sometimes they're not jumping on points.
Well,
they're
jumping
off points.
Late 90s now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean if it did do anything, it doesn't anymore.
Yeah. It's an excuse to stop reading. It's what Chris Ulm and I call, we call it the Daffy Duck trick, because it's like in the cartoon where Daffy's trying to one-up Bugs Bunny, and the last thing he does is he blows himself up with dynamite, and his ghost is going up to heaven, and Bugs says, "You did it, the audience loves you," and Daffy goes, "Yeah, but what do I do for an encore?" So they all strike me as being Daffy Duck tricks to a large extent, and I just don't see where this it has to end in tears. That's I don't see any way around it.
I don't know how they get out of it at this point. I mean, every retailer complains about it, and then every retailer orders more number ones than they did of the number 14 before it.
Sure. Well, so, they got to make the rent. You know, they got to sell books to people who come through the doors. And I blame the retailers because they're part of the problem, but I don't blame them for doing what succeeds. Mm-hmm. I think that the problem is there's nobody in the equation that's looking out for the long-term viability of the form. Mm-hmm. Or the characters. Nobody, I mean, the guys at the publishers are focused on their next quarter and making their numbers so they don't get fired. And the retailers are focused on selling books to the dwindling number of people come through the door so they can make the rent. I don't blame them. But who's looking out for, who's looking for new readers, for one, and who's looking out for these characters and these properties long term? You know, they say it takes 20 years to grow a tree and 5 minutes to burn it down. And I feel an awful lot with the way they've handled these comic book brands, so they're just burning the trees down.
Yeah, I'm
on that positive note.
Yeah. Go to Thrillbent. We don't burn things there.
No, it's digital.
It's digital. It's the future. It's cool. It's the new hotness.
Use the app. Don't use the website on your iPhone.
Yeah, yeah. Go get the Thrillbent app on your pad, on your iPad or Android pad. Enjoy it there.
All right. Well, any last words, guys, where we're going to give Paul a chance to finally – maybe Paul will get a chance to finally plug one of his things. So maybe we can – go ahead, right. Paul. Let's wrap this guy up with one more time. Tell him – I think – what was it called again? Thrill
– Thrillbent. Thrillbent.com. Mark Waid's Thrillbent.com, boldly charting the future of digital comics. And you should go there and read everything, but you should be especially certain to check out 4 Seconds, which I wrote. It's my love note to comics fans everywhere. It's a grim story, I'll tell you. It's got some darkness in it. It's got a pivot in the middle. It's kind of ugly and horrible, but you know what? I think this story is really interesting.
I really enjoyed it. I can tell you straight up.
I think it packs a punch.
No BS, Paul, not just because you're on the show and because you're a buddy. I really did enjoy it. I remember I sent the link to Brett, and he read it immediately, and he messaged me back going, good job, Paul, good job. You know,
that's
and
awesome.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's great.
That's the reward, really, is that I was able to put something out that people enjoy.
Feedback, people giving you positive feedback so far?
Yeah, I mean, not a lot of feedback. I'm mostly from, you know, friends and friends of friends, like some comments on Twitter and some emails come in. It's been very nice. I did – now, this sounds so ridiculous. But today I did have a phone conversation with a Hollywood movie producer about 4 Seconds. But wow.
Was it Steven Spielberg?
Friend. No, it wasn't Steven Spielberg. he's not speaking to me anymore. I pitched to Steven several years ago. He hasn't spoken to me since.
Yeah, going through the archives for the Long Box Graveyard podcast. That's your most listened to episode ever. Your second most listened to was the one you did with Superior Spider Talk. So.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea which one was. Yeah, but, yeah, you're right. I did do a podcast around that. It was a friend of a friend who's, you know, does some movie and television. Production. He just called me to see, hey, what's up with 4 Seconds? I liked it. You know, let's talk. You know, that's cool. I'm glad to get that call, but I don't
the reason I did it was because I wanted to make a great comic, and hopefully we succeeded. That's at thrillbent.com. And then if I can throw in another plug, please remember longboxgraveyard.com. That's my Silver and Bronze Age comic blog, where I'm doing a lot of making of 4 Second stuff, but there's also all this new Marvel stuff. And then once a month, at least, there's some kind of throwback article about comic books of the past. So there's plenty of stuff there to enjoy. Something like I'm up to episode 155 or something. So there's lots and lots and lots of content there about Silver and Bronze Age comics to explore.
Absolutely. You know what? It's amazing, actually, to me, how well you keep up that that website, considering everything else you have going on.
It's amazing to me, too. every time, it's like, maybe I should stop this. But it's fun, and I'm better off having it than not. So what I've done over time is I've just kind of reduced my commitment to it. I used to publish every week. Now, for big articles, I'm down to once a month, notwithstanding I've been doing these capsule reviews for Marvel every day. I'm going to go back to once a month pretty soon, and I'll keep this thing going a long time yet.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, everybody. And on that note, what is it we like to say? We're OUT? Is that what you say, Keith?
That is what I say.
Excellent.
You should listen all the way to the end of the shows.
I should listen to the shows. Good night, folks.
We've done great ones.